Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a professorial fellow in American literature and chair of public understanding of the humanities at the School of Advanced Study, the University of London. Her expertise is in 20th and 21st century fiction. She's judged the Booker Prize, the Women's Prize for Fiction, and the David Cohen Prize for Literature, and she's a director of the Being Human Festival. She's a frequent contributor to many international publications and a renowned critic. She's written three books so far, and her most recent is Behold America. Professor Sarah Churchwell, thanks so much for coming to join me. So the full title of your hugely acclaimed and timely book is Behold America, A History of America First and the American Dream. And I wondered if you could take us back to your own American childhood in Chicago and what America meant to you then.
So as you say, I grew up in Chicago in the 80s under Reagan, and that was sort of my political worldview, I suppose. I mean, I wasn't a fan of his even as a young girl, and I didn't grow up in a family that was particularly Reaganite in that sense. I grew up with what I think of as traditional liberal values, progressive values. Those were things that my parents instilled in me. And, you know, my grandparents were kind of classic Kennedy voters, that sort of white, suburban, liberal, university-educated stereotype, if you like, but, you know, template of a certain type of American identity. And that was very much how I grew up. And certainly was, I think, in a generation where we believed that, as I think a lot of people did until quite recently, that certain political battles had been won and that, you know, kind of liberal democracy was here to stay and it was just a question of fine-tuning it. That said, you know, I mean, the suburb of Chicago that I grew up was very WASPy, as we say, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. The one next door to us, which is called Skokie, Illinois, is highly Jewish. It's something like 90%, 95% Jewish. And particularly in the 80s, a lot of people who lived in Skokie were actually Holocaust survivors or relatives of Holocaust survivors, or indeed victims, I should say. But I mean, they had families who were very much victims of the Holocaust. And I remember in the early 80s, I think it was 81, when a neo-Nazi group decided to march in Skokie. And it became a huge national story because they targeted this Jewish village. And the ACLU, which is the American Civil Liberties Union, defended the neo-Nazis' right to march in a Jewish village because of freedom of speech, because of the First Amendment, because of their right to gather, to assemble, which is also guaranteed in the First Amendment. And as it happens, and I've actually never understood this, I keep meaning to go back to my parents and ask them what was going on. For some reason, local news came to my junior school to ask us what we thought. And because I was one of those kids who could, you know, I could talk a lot even before I knew what the hell I was talking about. The words came out. And I had no idea, obviously. I was like 10 or something, 11. But I ended up on the local news talking about the neo-Nazis marching in Skokie. And I've kind of been reflecting on that since I wrote this book, that maybe that was somehow always in there, that somehow I was always going to tell that story. And that to me is a kind of microcosm of the fact that there we were telling ourselves that the problem was over and the neo-Nazis were literally marching next door. So the problem was never over, but the national myths didn't let us look at that clearly. And that's really what my book is about, is saying our national myths are effacing our actual history. And I wanted to go back and look at that history that I was very much not taught in school in the 80s.
Mm. In terms of school, study-wise, you went to Vassar College and then did a couple of degrees at Princeton.
Yeah, that's right. So those, and Vassar is in New York and Princeton is in New Jersey, just outside of New York City. So I've been joking for a while, I've been kind of steadily moving east. So yeah, I did most of my education in the broader New York area. And I was very much focused on literature. That was what I thought I wanted to do. And I was actually very apolitical, as a lot of literary students, at least in my generation, were. I mean, not apolitical in the sense that I was very interested in social politics, but I wasn't particularly interested in geopolitics. And I didn't think that was something that I really cared about. And I kind of wanted, as young people I think sometimes do, I wanted a literature that was somehow kept pure of politics. But it was very much of the generation that was educated to be sensitive to questions of politics and literature and what we came to call identity politics, and to think about postcolonialism and to think about sexual politics and to think about racial politics. And so I only gradually realized that I had always been thinking politically. I just wasn't aware of it. Mm. But I think, like a lot of people, I've become much more politically minded since the crash, really, in the last decade or so, as I've seen things that I took for granted start to be questioned.
You pick up on the whole idea of sexual politics. Where first, you write about a couple of the most famous people in America. So your first book was about Marilyn Monroe, where those questions of identity and sexual politics are examined.
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of came at politics through sexual politics. And again, I think that's something that a lot of women probably could identify with, that was the first place where I experienced politics and understood that these were political questions and that they were affecting my life and the lives of people I cared about. And actually, the very first long piece of writing I did as an undergraduate, my senior thesis, was on feminism and fairy tales. And so I've always kind of been interested in that. I did the Marilyn book came out of my PhD thesis, which was about, one professor referred to it as the famous dead chicks dissertation. It was a thesis on the posthumous writing on the afterlives of Marilyn Monroe, Sylvia Plath, and Janis Joplin. And I was really looking at these women who died between 1962 and 1970 as the second wave of feminism took hold, and looking at the way that in supposedly the third wave of feminism that these women were written about. And what I discovered was that if you take them as kind of case studies of attitudes, cultural attitudes toward famous women, that I saw a lot of attitudes going backwards, and I saw post-feminism getting entrenched. I saw backlash getting entrenched in the way that these stories were told. They were profoundly sexist and profoundly misogynistic in ways that now people, you know, raise eyebrows, but that people took for granted at the time. And so I was kind of calling attention to that and then ended up doing a book about the Marilyn stuff. But it was funny because when I wrote a book about Marilyn Monroe, I wrote a book about the Great Gatsby, and then I've written this book about America First and the American Dream. And I've had people say that's three very different books. And at first I did kind of think, wow, yeah, I am sort of all over the place. But it was only when I wrote this book that I realized that, and that this does go back to Marilyn, I've actually been writing about the American Dream the whole time. Mm-hmm. And Marilyn Monroe is very much an American Dream story. And that's really what that book is about the failure of the American Dream in her life, because she should have been an example of it. She came from nothing. And she built herself up through hard work to be the most successful person in the world in her career. And all we talk about her in terms of it is failure. All we ever do is pity Marilyn. All we ever do is talk about how sad she was and how destroyed she was and how much she suffered and always how sexualized she was. And still people assume she was dumb. You know, when it was a performance, she was an actress. She was not stupid by any stretch of the imagination. And she was at the top of a cutthroat profession in a sexist age for a decade. And you don't do that by luck. You don't do that by lack of talent. And you certainly don't do that if you're stupid. Mm. And I realized, but even with the American Dream, you know, that she changed her name, that whole sense of American reinvention, that she started this poor girl who had nothing and she built herself up to this incredible success story. And yet when it comes to Marilyn, we will not talk about her in those terms. Nobody ever talks about her as a success story. Mm. And that's really what my book was about, was, you know, she is one. And can we give her that credit?
That theme, as you say, of the American Dream picked up again in your next book, which was all about the true story behind F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby.
Yeah, that book for me was, obviously one doesn't spend a lot of time writing a book that one doesn't believe in or feel passionate about, but the Gatsby book is really probably the one that's closest to my heart. You're not supposed to have a favorite child, but it sort of is my favorite child. And that's because for me, it brought together all of the things that I love the most. It's the most literary of my three books. It's the one where I really kind of let that passion out and have fun with it and try to share why I love The Great Gatsby so much and why I love the language of it and why I think it's still such a remarkable book. But I wanted to play with biography, which is something I do a lot within the Marilyn book. So really trying to improve our understanding of Scott Fitzgerald's life to bring new biographical facts to bear. I did a lot of original research into not just his and Zelda's life, but into the way that they were written about at the time. So it sort of took that idea of afterlives that I worked on with the Marilyn book and took the same technique, but applied it to the way they were written about at the time. So in scholarly terms, we call it reception studies or reception history. How were they received? And with the Marilyn stuff, it was how was she received after she died. With Scott Fitzgerald, I was looking at how he was received while he was alive and how that shaped his celebrity persona and how those ideas and how the world that he lived in, how can we recreate the world that he lived in, which is the world that he was writing about in Gatsby? What I wanted to do was to get back to the idea, we think of Gatsby as an historical novel, but only because its time has passed. Mm. But he was writing a contemporary novel.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I wanted to get back to that contemporary world and to see if I could make it fresh, make it new, bring it back to life. And eventually what I realized I wanted to do was to try to write a nonfiction version of Gatsby, which is what the book ended up being.
Then you were going to write about Henry James.
I'm still going to write about Henry James, but I had to hit pause. Well, there was a little problem called Donald Trump.
Well, the book that's come out of it, Behold America, feels so immediate, so urgent. It's history as it's being made. And as you said, it's a natural progression, really, on from Gatsby, the ideas of the American dream. Now, both phrases, America First and the American dream, have been around for 100 years, just as America started to become a dominant nation. Give us some sense of that time.
Yeah. It was... Both phrases emerged about 100 years ago, and that time really was in many ways similar to ours. Obviously, the differences are profound, and one can dwell on them at length, but the similarities are there, and I really do think that the America that we know emerged at this point, and it was Scott Fitzgerald who put his finger on it. He saw it sooner and clearer than anybody else where America was going. He wasn't the only one in his generation who saw it, and he learned from those people, but they understood that America was selling itself out, that it was selling itself out for money and for materialism. And they had grown up with an understanding that America was supposed to dream bigger. And I should say rather, as I say in the book, we keep thinking we should dream bigger. But in fact, what they were saying and what Fitzgerald was saying was that we need to dream better and that there was a moral aspect to it. There was supposed to be a moral aspect to the American experiment. It was supposed to be a place where we could try to do better, which isn't to say that it had to be complacent or smug or self-idealizing or self-satisfied or any of those things that it sometimes gets accused of, and particularly in terms of American exceptionalism. You can say we're trying to do better and recognize that you're not doing better. You can recognize that you're failing and say this is a country that's supposed to try to do better, and that was supposed to be our purpose. And the reason why I would say that it was a very similar time is because they were coming to grips with massive economic inequality, and they were really looking at what that was doing to society, and they were... Certainly people on the progressive side of the debate were arguing that with the kind of inequality that had started to run rampant in the Gilded Age, so at the turn of the century when Fitzgerald and his generation were growing up and coming of age, and you've got, you know, the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the Carnegies and Frick and, you know, all of those guys, all of the robber barons, the industrialists who were creating monopoly capitalism, which would morph into corporate capitalism. And they were concentrating wealth at the top, and poverty was increasing at the bottom, and the middle class was growing at that time, but the gap between rich and poor was also widening. And they were very concerned about what possibilities for democracy would exist in such a time. And one of the things that I found that really amazed me was that the earliest uses of the phrase the American dream that I found, which isn't to say they're the earliest that exist, which some people have said, and they're the earliest I was able to find. There may be earlier, but that talk about the American dream as a national value system, as a way of talking about what the nation was supposed to stand for, come from just about 1900, 1899, 1900. And they're talking about this new phenomenon of the multimillionaire. And they say that the multimillionaire will be the death of the American dream. It will be the end of the American dream, because that kind of massive private wealth means opportunity only for the few, not the many. It means basically recreating an aristocracy. It means you will have inherited privilege. It means that you will have an oligarchy. It means that you will have, and they could see clearly that that's what having that kind of mass wealth at the top would do. And they said the American experiment is against that kind of vast private wealth because it's inherently anti-democratic and because we're about egalitarianism. And you can't have egalitarianism where you have that kind of inequality. And that is where the phrase the American dream comes from.
What about America First? Mm. What are the roots of that?
Yeah. So America First emerged at the same time. And one of the reasons I ended up writing this book on the back of the Gatsby research in the wake of Donald Trump's decision to resuscitate the phrase America First was that I kept seeing commentators, and excellent commentators, historians, and, you know, The New Yorker was writing this, and all the major American papers were saying this, and historians were saying it, that the phrase America First emerged in 1940, 1941 with Charles Lindbergh. Although I am not trained as an historian, certainly not as a political historian, I am a cultural historian by practice over the last 20 years. But I knew from the research I'd done into Scott Fitzgerald's 1920s that America First was all over the 1920s. I just kept encountering it. I had seen it all over the place. So I knew it predated Charles Lindbergh by a long way, and that it was an important part of the political debates in America in the 1920s over isolationism, over protectionism, over tariffs, the same kinds of things we're seeing now, but also that it had a very clear and highly charged racial and ethnic dimension to it. And that those were very clear. There were immigration laws passed in 1924 in the name of America First that were highly xenophobic, highly eugenicist. And that was very much at the heart of the world that Scott Fitzgerald was writing about in The Great Gatsby. People sometimes forget, or they wonder why Tom Buchanan, the villain of The Great Gatsby, is a white supremacist. And he calls himself a Nordic, which, of course, was another name for what Hitler would call Aryan. So it's a version of white supremacism, and it's a eugenicist notion that white people from Northern Europe are biologically superior to other races. And that idea of Nordicism was totally tied into America First. It would not have been at all surprising had Scott Fitzgerald used the phrase America First in The Great Gatsby. Mm. He happened not to, but he could easily have done it. Tom Buchanan could easily have stood up and said, I'm for America First. And it would have been completely contemporary. His audience would completely have understood that. And the phrase really gained traction around the turn of the teens to the 20s in the post-First World War era, particularly around the debates over the Treaty of Versailles and America staying out of the League of Nations. So it had this kind of isolationist history to it.
Mm. When Donald Trump was announcing his candidacy for presidency, he said the American dream is dead and talked about how he was going to put America first. Now, both of those phrases would certainly have been familiar to Fred C. Trump.
Indeed. So Frederick Christ Trump, to give him his full name, that was a family name, but it's hard not to enjoy the laugh. He, who was, of course, Trump's father. Now, people have slightly misread this sometimes and assumed that because Fred Trump was an adult in the 20s, that he must have been Trump's grandfather. And in fact, reviews of my books talked about Fred Trump as his grandfather. And I was like, no. The point is, he's his father. We forget, and I think to our peril, first of all, how old Donald Trump is. He was born in 1946. And secondly, that he was the son of a much older father. So Fred C. Trump actually was a young man in this era that I'm talking about in the 20s. And so the world that he inhabited was this America First, isolationist, xenophobic, eugenicist world, like Tom Buchanan, that took that stuff for granted. It was a highly racist society. And even the more progressive people were, of course, very, very racist in many of their attitudes. And Fred Trump raised Donald Trump, you know, in the 40s, in my view, with this worldview. And basically what I'm saying in the book is the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. And Trump has said over and over again how much he admires his father, how much he adheres to his father's worldview. Most importantly, in my view, the thing he said over and over and over again is that he is a believer in eugenics. Now, Trump himself never remembers the word eugenics, but that's neither here nor there. The attitudes that he's espousing, he says over and over again, he's given dozens of interviews, easy to find. Just Google Donald Trump and eugenics, and you see him on video for 20 years, 30 years, saying that he's a believer in what he calls the gene theory, or he's a believer in genes. He believes in what he thinks of as the racehorse theory of genes, which is that when you get a superior type person and you marry that superior type person to another superior type person, you get superior type people. Well, that is eugenicism. And that is very clearly what he believes. And in Fred Trump's world, that idea was America First.
And you can place Fred Trump historically right at the heart of that.
Indeed. So in 1927, it was actually just at the kind of peak of America First's political traction. It was just starting to lose credibility, partly because of the way that it had been monetized. So it was getting associated with corruption, both by the Klan and with a very corrupt Chicago mayor from my hometown, the most corrupt city in America, a guy called Big Bill Thompson, who was using America First to try to, it was a money-making scheme. Also, some things also never change. Anyway, so it was about to kind of really lose credence. But at the peak of it, in 1927 in Queens, which, of course, is where Donald Trump would eventually grow up, it's where Fred Trump was already living at that point. And there was a Memorial Day parade in May 1927 at which the Klan controversially had been permitted to march. They were given a permit. Now, this incident has, since Trump's election, been erroneously described as a Klan rally. And I think it's important that we note the distinction. It was a Memorial Day parade at which the veterans were marching and the Red Cross was marching and children were marching. And there were 20,000 spectators, not because they wanted to support the Klan, but because they were there for a national parade. But the Klan had, as I say, controversially been given permission to march in this parade as long as they weren't robed, was what the police told them. And it was a First Amendment issue, again, about the right to assemble and the right to free speech. And so you can see why they said that they could, but that they couldn't be hooded and gowned. And some of them decided to be hooded and gowned. And scuffles broke out among the 20,000 spectators because some actually objected to it as hate speech, just as we would today. Some defended it on the basis of freedom of speech, just as people would today. So these kind of scuffles broke out, and it turned into a full-blown riot, 20,000 people fighting over the Klan in Queens. And out of that 20,000, six men were arrested, five of whom self-identified in the police reports as Klansmen. And the sixth was Fred C. Trump. Now, that is not proof that Fred Trump was a Klansman. And again, some people have said that that arrest shows that he was. I don't think that it does. I don't think we can make quite that step. But it is remarkable to me that out of 20,000 people, only six were arrested, five of whom were Klansmen and one of whom was Trump. And what I do say in the book is that, and I firmly believe this, is that whatever we think Fred Trump's reasons for being there might have been, he was not there to protest the Klan. And we know that because of his later record on race relations. He was so racist when he started his property development in the 1950s, which, by the way, he got from government loans. So all of these guys who, you know, they hate government handouts, but that's how Fred Trump got his start, was from a government handout.
And there was some kind of illegality associated with it.
Indeed, he was hauled up before a congressional committee to admit that he wildly overstated the cost of his loans, which, as I say in the book, some might call fraud. So he defrauded the government to get handouts. And then his son is telling us the handouts are terrible and nobody should have handouts. And out of this, he built these tenements. He built these housing projects in the New York area, in Brooklyn and in Queens. And his policies for renting to tenants in these housing projects were so racist that Woody Guthrie in the 1950s wrote a song about how racist it was because he lived in one of them. It's called Old Man Trump, and it's about how racist Fred Trump was. And you have to be really racist in the 50s to get people's attention for how racist you are. By 1973, which was the year that Donald Trump took over the Trump property empire from his father, they were sued by the Nixon administration for racial discrimination. And again, you know, the Nixon administration was not going out of its way to sue people over racial discrimination. It had to be so gratuitous for the Nixon administration to go after them. And then, of course, in the case of Donald, there are things like the Central Park Five, the five black men wrongly accused of raping a woman in Central Park. He called for the death penalty with them. They were totally exonerated by DNA. He has never apologized. He has never said that. He still calls it a miscarriage of justice. And it was a miscarriage of justice, but not in the way that he thinks. So what I say is that although we cannot say that Fred Trump was a card-carrying member of the KKK, he was arrested with five of them, and nothing that he ever did in the rest of his misbegotten life makes me think that he was there to argue against the Klan.
Do you think then that, A, Trump, Donald Trump, has a full understanding, given how ignorant and he and most of his supporters appear to be, an understanding of the origin of these phrases, and can they be reinterpreted in a positive way? Mm.
So, first of all, I think that for me, the best way to understand this is that it's like it's a worldview that he grew up with. He's profoundly racist. We have so much evidence to see how racist he is. Does he know the detailed history of this? Of course not. In fact, historians don't know the detailed history of this, or I wouldn't have written the book. So nobody knows it. But the fact that America First has these meanings is definitely not lost to history. And the KKK kept it alive underground. And all of these neo-Nazi groups and right-wing groups kept this phrase alive. And there's lots of evidence of that. They would have rallies in the 60s and say it's an America First rally. You can find the kind of flyers and handbills and stuff. So there's lots of ephemeral evidence over the years that they kept this phrase alive. And now they're using it on neo-Nazi message boards. It's on the Daily Stormer. It's on Stormfront. It's on their websites. So these guys have always used that phrase. And when David Duke, who of course is the most senior member of the KKK in America, when he endorsed Donald Trump, he did so using that phrase. He said he stands for what I've always stood for. He stands for America First. It is a racist dog whistle. And certainly Trump's advisors know that. Steve Bannon does read history. And Steve Bannon does know this. Steve Bannon also resuscitated a phrase called economic nationalism, which he talks about all the time. And most people don't realize that economic nationalism was part of the America First platform in 1919 and 1920. And it was to keep America out of the League of Nations, to keep it from signing the Treaty of Versailles, because Europe was was a cabal of overlords who wanted to create a global economy, and they were going to make America a vassal state, which should sound pretty familiar. And it's not only about the ways that that has shaped American political debates, but of course it sounds an awful lot like the way that people talk about Brexit. And as we know, Bannon has been closely involved. Cambridge Analytica, which he was on the board of, has been closely involved with both of these campaigns. And his idea of economic nationalism is a 100-year-old America First agenda. He did not pluck that phrase out of the air. Stephen Miller, who remains Trump's senior advisor, he's the author of the policy that's separating immigrant families at the southern border. He was also clearly the author of the speech that Trump gave in the Oval Office when he argued for his wall. So Stephen Miller also knows this stuff. And the other phrase that was really associated with America First, which I spend a lot of time explaining in the book, was 100% American, which was another code. And Stephen Miller wrote on his high school yearbook page that he was 100% American. So these guys do know these codes. And as I say, I don't know that Donald Trump understands all of this history and understands how all of it intersects, but he knows that it all supports his basic worldview, which is a eugenicist worldview, and that is the one that he learned from his father, who also knew that this stuff was America First. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if he had grown up in the 50s hearing his father talk about America First. That wouldn't surprise me one little bit.
So is the American dream dead, and do we revive it by putting America first?
Yeah. My view is that we shouldn't try. It's like saying, can we resuscitate Heil Hitler? Well, you could, but why would you want to? I want to do the opposite, which is to discredit it with certainly people are using it innocently. But I feel about those people as I would feel if I met somebody using Heil Hitler innocently. I wouldn't say, oh, well, good for you. You don't really know what it means. So off you go then. Not to worry. Keep using it. I would sit them down and say, there's a terrible history here that you might want to be aware of the next time you think about using that phrase. I don't think you can get rid of that kind of history. But also because of the way now, even in the years since Trump assumed the presidency, it has gotten back tangled up in current debates, in the ways in which America's arguing about the history of the Confederacy again, about the way that we're arguing about the Confederate statues, about the terrible events in Charlottesville in August 2017 when you have, you know, neo-Nazis and KKK members marching together shouting, Jews will not replace us, and America First was tangled up in that. So, no, I don't think you can make it innocent. It never was innocent, and I don't know why we would try. I think the American dream can be reclaimed because the American dream still has so much that's positive associated with it and so much that is aspirational and idealistic. I think it has become, in my view, as an American citizen and as just, you know, a human being, I personally think it's been very degraded by the way that it's been turned into this kind of dream of materialism, so that 100 years ago they would say that a multimillionaire was the death of the American dream. And of course today, no American, I think, except me, you know, would use that phrase to say that. And people think that becoming a multimillionaire or billionaire is the realization of the American dream. But certainly that progressive argument that inequality is destroying the American dream is very alive, very pertinent. And so I thought it was really hopeful. I found it really liberating to discover that the American dream had this early progressive history. And it seemed to me particularly that it gives a rebuttal to the right-wing commentators in America who are always telling us that the American dream is antithetical to any kind of regulation of capitalism, that it's radical free market capitalism, that it's libertarian capitalism, and that's the American dream, and you can't possibly argue that anything like social democracy could, or a welfare state could have anything to do with the American dream. Well, I'm sorry to tell you guys, but the American dream was literally coined to argue the opposite. And I find that really, as I say, I find that emancipatory. I find that a really, it means that history is on our side. It means that they can't just claim this certain national mythology and use it to beat us with. It's one that they have invented. And the progressive history of America is a robust one. And the American dream is partly an economic ideal of egalitarianism, of opportunity, of economic justice. And that history is there, and it's absolutely worth reclaiming.
Sarah Churchwell, thank you so much. Behold America, A History of America First and the American Dream by Sarah Churchwell is published by Bloomsbury and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and May Lee Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.